I thought we would we'll have a discussion now. I wanted to read a few, see if I can find it, a few pieces from the suttas that show examples of service from the time of the Buddha. And you know, there's kind of a bad rap, I think, of Vipassana insight meditation as it being a selfish practice, you know, that you're trying to liberate yourself from this suffering. And, you know, I don't think that rings out true, and people like Bhikkhu Bodhi really speak to that. But there are some examples from the suttas that really give, I think, a nice image of service. And you know, basically, the main one is of the service that the Buddha did by, you know, discovering the Dhamma and then teaching it, going on to teaching it. And, you know, he really, you know, as a legend goes, he left this, you know, very comfortable life because there was the compassionate response to suffering. He saw for the first time in really tangible ways what suffering is, and was inspired to do something about it, which meant leave his home life, his family, and go out and meditate and work through the Dhamma, and then to spend the rest of his life teaching it. One story I like is the story of Angulimala. This is the story of a serial killer in the time of the Buddha. I'm giving you all these images like the saw and all these bandits and stuff, but it wasn't intentional. And I talk about other things too, but you know, it's very striking. So Angulimala. Anguli means finger, and mala means necklace. So this was a serial killer who lived at the time of the Buddha, who had a necklace of human fingers from his victims. And the Buddha knew about this, and also knew through his compassion that Angulimala was ripe to get the teachings of the Dhamma and to, you know, change his ways. So he goes out to the forest to encounter this Angulimala, who's, you know, supposedly very strong and ferocious, and, you know, the Buddha's, I don't know, we have different pictures of him, but he's not really a pugilist by any sense, or I don't know if he knew any martial arts, but so he, despite everyone's advice for him not to go into the woods, he goes out there and he encounters Angulimala, and I won't go into the whole story, but basically faces Angulimala, and Angulimala, you know, in the, changes his way, you know, right on the scene, and gives up the violence. And so that's an image of compassion, you know, risking his life in that case to convert someone from killing. There's a really vivid story from the Vinaya. This is part of the Pali Canon that has the rules for the monks and the nuns. And there's stories, we don't have a whole lot of historical documents of what happened. Most of the Pali Canon comes in the form of teachings, you know, and practical teachings. But there's a lot of history that can be gleaned from this document. And there's one story where the Buddha and Ananda, that's his cousin who is his, you know, kind of his aide, or, you know, what's the word? Assistant.
Yeah. Attendant.
For many years, they were walking along, and they encountered this sick monk with dysentery who was sitting in his own filth. And they said, you know, to this monk, you know, what's wrong with you? And he said, well, I've got dysentery. And dysentery, for those of you who don't know, is it's an intestinal infection. Usually from an infection, it's can be quite severe. People die from it. In fact, it's one of the leading causes of death of children under five in undeveloped nations. And it was, you know, obviously a problem at the time and a problem now. And you have uncontrollable diarrhea and fevers and body aches and, you know, die a horrible death, you know, if you don't recover. So he said, I have dysentery. And they said, well, you know, how come the other monks aren't taking care of you? He was alone. And he says, because I'm useless to them. Mm-hmm. And so the Buddha told Ananda, you know, go fetch some water, we'll clean him up. And they, you know, they cleaned him up and carried him to his bed. And then he called the monks together. You know, the stories always kind of go this way when there's a teaching moment. And he says, you know, monks, is there a member among you that has dysentery? And they said, yes, venerable sir. That's how they always replied. And he said, well, how come nobody's tending to him? And they said, well, he's useless. You know, basically what the monk said, he's useless to us. And he said, well, you have no mother and you have no father, because these are people who are monastics and they've given up the homeless life and they just have the sangha, this community of monks and nuns. So if you don't look after each other, who will look after you? And he said, you should care for, you know, the sick among you as you would for me. Just kind of a similar, I think there's a teaching from the Bible like that. So that was... that's really kind of a moving image of, you know, the Buddha actually, you know, cleaning up, you know, diarrhea off of this guy and taking care of him. The last image is really a simile, another analogy, and it's the simile of the acrobat. And I think this is an important, it's a pretty well-known tale or teaching. The Buddha's again with the group of monks and lay people and his teaching, and he tells the story of an acrobat and assistant. And I get the image of, in ancient India, of like a roadside event. You know, this is how these people made their living. They did various acrobatic tricks. You know, sometimes there would be troops. In this case, there was a master and his apprentice, and the in this case, they're balancing on a pole. And the acrobat, the teacher, says to the student, who will use the feminine pronoun, is, you know, says to her, you climb up on my shoulders, I'll look after you, and you look after me, we'll do our tricks, and you'll climb down, we'll collect our money, and all will be well. And she says to him, no, that won't do at all. I'll climb up your shoulders and I'll look after me and you look after you, and then I'll climb down, we'll collect our money and all will be well. So that's the story. And the Buddha said, actually she was right, the apprentice, that second one was right, because if you don't look after yourself first, you're not able to look after others. So he said that really we have to, and actually the way he said you look after yourself is through mindfulness. That, and you can imagine this balancing on someone's shoulders. If you're thinking about, oh, I hope their legs are okay, and, you know, I hope they keep their balance, you're not really paying attention to what you need to be doing on these shoulders. So it's a really striking image. And then he goes on to say that by looking, in order to look after ourselves, we need to practice these four foundations of mindfulness. And in order to look after others, he says we need to practice patience, non-harming, and loving kindness. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that little list that he gives on how to look after others. So I thought this last part we could kind of be interactive. I've thought about different ways that we, in doing service, we can trip up, and we've talked about some of those and how to kind of frame it in a dharmic sense and how to work with it, and there's a lot of ways, and we can, you know, just feel free to contribute at any point. But I came up with a different list of things that I've done or that I've, you know, that have really you know, basically, I guess what the issue is what we were talking about earlier, about keeping suffering at arm's length, you know, not being with it in a equanimous way, you know, in a healthy way that's productive and skillful. And we talked about the indifference and the apathy, you know, not caring. And I've come up with some phrases that I can hear, like voices echo in my mind when this is happening. And one of them is, whatever, you know, and that's kind
it
of
is what it is.
It is what it is, or who cares? You know, that's a little more harsh, you know, or it's not my problem. You know, might be another way that we can frame that. And then I thought about minimizing. sometimes we minimize the situation or someone's suffering, and that might look like, oh, it's not so bad, you know, it's not so bad. Or, well, we all suffer. You know, that'd be another way to kind of minimize it. Along the lines is also denial. You know, just to be in complete denial that, you know, there's really no suffering here. That's, you know, again, that's not so bad. The other extreme can be, you know, exaggeration or maybe feeling overwhelmed. You know, I talked about the burnout that I had, you know, many years ago, and trying to, you know, having an intention to be skillful and helpful, and then getting really overwhelmed. You know, it's just too much. You know, I can't handle this. And I think it's skillful to really recognize that, you know, because we aren't Buddhas, you know, who can go into the forest to grapple the mass murderer, maybe, you know, or endure the bandit sighing. That's from Limb to Limb. So it's important to, I think, have that equanimity and to know what our limits are, and then maybe use that as an edge to, you know, push gently with ourselves, push beyond that, those limits, you know, as we practice more. We talked about pity, so when I'm using the term that poor person, or, you know, that poor, you know, lost soul, or, you know, to kind of have some of that language around, you know, of pity, that's really not helpful, you know, for me. That's a form of clinging. Then there can be blaming. You can blame people for their own circumstances. Well, they got themselves into this mess. You know, might be a voice that I might use with that. It's also feeling better than the superiority, like, you know, I'm serving you, or I'm, you know, using my expertise to help you. I think that's another way that kind of separates us and removes us, and, you know, doesn't help with breaking down the barriers. The opposite is, you know, type of comparison is feeling less than or inferior. You know, kind of service as a form of penance, you know, that I'm not a good person and therefore I've got to, you know, walk on my knees, or, you know, do, you know, the service that's, you know, really difficult and, you know, maybe too much and not appropriate for me. One thing I've learned well in my job is professional distance, you know, to have that kind of, you know, I'm a doctor, you know, I see it with other healing professions, or I'm, you know, someone of expertise, and to not really let the heart open, to kind of close it off, to, you know, try and see that as a skillful technique, you know, as a really, I really think it's a defense mechanism, you know, that at the time I wasn't able to really be present fully to the degree of suffering. I still struggle with it, but it's a little easier now. So there's this whole kind of, and a lot, I think a lot of healing professions kind of teach that sort of, I think there's other words for it, but that, you know, kind of having a certain professional stance to not let the suffering in. The fear there being that we can't be with the suffering, that it's too much. And that on some level that's true, but on the other level, that if we really stick with the practice and we, you know, we take maybe baby steps, or we kind of work with an edge, that we can be with a whole lot more suffering than maybe we can imagine. Another thing that I've done is promoting my self-identity or my beliefs, you know, rather than trying truly to be of service or be helpful in a situation. You know, I mentioned earlier this hiding a good intention, or an unskillful intention with a good one, you know, the typical scenario of wanting to look good, you know, since I'm, you know, doing such a service. That's one I fall into. We can also abstract suffering. We can make it abstract, you know, making it metaphysical, for example, you know, a phrase that we might say as well, it's just karma. You know, that person, sometimes we'll hear that about suffering is somebody's, you know, they're getting their karma. And that's not my, I don't think that's true to the real teachings about karma, but I've certainly fallen into that trap where, you know, I see someone suffering and say, well, they must have done something really bad at some point to get this. Or, you know, the other token is maybe I could say to somebody who is causing me stress or that I'm having a conflict with is, you know, well, they'll get their karma, you know. I've done that too. And I know that it's just a way of really not being with what's going on in the situation. It's a defense that I've put up. We can also intellectualize suffering. There's abstracting. We can intellectualize it. They're kind of similar. And what that might look like is these teachings on anatta that I mentioned, and the not-self. We can say, well, there's no one here to suffer. You know, we're all not selves. I'm saying this is the delusion that I have fallen under, and that I think is fairly common in Buddhist circles, is that no one is suffering, and I think that really dehumanizes it and isn't really true to the teachings. Then there's the martyr or martyrdom, when we're really maybe that's similar to the walking, the penance, the feeling inferior, but really trying to sacrifice one's own best interests in and not serving oneself. And sometimes that takes the shape of serving out of anger or outrage, and that has been a very effective tool of social change. I think we all know, or maybe have been, angry social activists at one point. And the problem with that is that it's, when you have something that has that root of aversion at the core of it, it's there may be some skill that comes out of it and something might get done, but there is more clinging and suffering that results. You mentioned the story about Sharon Salzberg, who was told by her teacher to hit that person over the head mm-hmm. with as much loving kindness as they can muster. And that's a very different feeling from striking out in rage at that. So I think we can be more effective, actually, by being in equanimity rather than being in outrage and anger. And then there's sometimes a thought that I'm fixing something that's broken. There's a judgment in there. There's kind of an offsetting that I'm like the expert and I'm fixing, or I have to change someone rather than aiding them to find their way to alleviate their suffering or do what they need to do. So that's another subtle one. Can anyone think of some other examples of keeping compassion, of I guess falling off this course of compassion that seeks to serve, or how we express the compassion in our lives and how we can get muddled up? Or maybe examples of the above, that really came to mind that you thought you'd like to share.
I'm not going to help this person because I'm afraid it will foster dependency or help this person just go out and maybe waste money I give to him on a habit.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I've heard the argument with these, we were talking about USAID and Bill and Melinda Gates, and there's all these organizations that are pouring, resources into these countries that have, a historical model of, people not living long. They have large families. A lot of the kids die. And the fear that a lot of people in the developing worlds have is that, well, we'll just support this unsustainable situation where they're going to continue to have these large families and they're, we're going to have overpopulation. And, you've probably heard these arguments. And And I don't know what the reality is. There's a really nice video on the Bill and Melinda Gates website. If you ever get a chance, they have a lot of interesting information about world suffering, about world and world humanitarian crisis. And they have some data that they present that, you know, the developmental model is if, as you are bringing up a culture or a country into, you know, a Western developmental economic model, that people get more education and they make decisions to have less families. I mean, and maybe we see that in our own country. And, you know, we look back 100, 200 years, some of the families, you know, had a lot more kids than they do these days. But I think, you know, I think that question has to be answered. But that's a big fear that I've heard about, you know, even for some of the groups I've gone with to do medical work abroad. There's been that question of, well, we're just, you know, throwing a Band-Aid on this, and it's just, you know, it's not doing any good. And even if it did, you're just kind of setting people up to have further problems down the line. But we don't know that. You know, we just try the best we can. We try and make an important, an intelligent, just, you know, choices and set the intention.
Seems to be a common criticism in the with providers who serve substance abusing families and teens who have early pregnancy, like helping them, afford them to continue living the lifestyle that they were living, like having lots of children while they're very young, and it perpetuates the problem, you know. And so a lot of people who fund organizations like that don't want to fund them because of that issue. And they encourage them to have sterilization or surgery to prevent having children.
Wow. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Something that comes to mind from Ajahn Brahm's teachings is he talks about how some doctors have an idea that they need to cure someone as opposed to caring for someone, which is a whole different flavor. And I was thinking about Toni Bernhardt's book about how to be sick and her journey with chronic fatigue. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that one doctor in particular had to come to this place in changing his attitude of realizing that he couldn't make her better, and instead had to realize he was working to help her live a better life, but that he couldn't cure what was wrong with her. And she said when he made that change, her relationship with the doctor changed and they could work together. But when the doctor was trying to just say, oh, I have to cure you, I have to fix you, that there's an underlying attitude that's different than caring for the patient and actually really seeing what's there and addressing that need. So I think sometimes we get into helping situations, compassionate action service, with some idea, and we have to constantly check, are we trying to maybe fix something as opposed to caring for something? You know, giving the compassionate response as opposed to a fixing response. And I think that that's it's a tricky place to be, but it's something to be aware of.
Thank you. Yes.
I think for me, personally, where I get hung up is I'll start with a good intention of being compassionate and listening, but then some ego gets stroked along the way a little bit, and then my ego pops in, and then I see myself, my intention changing from one of really being helpful to being more of like a teacher, or being, like you were saying, I don't remember, where you kind of are distancing yourself just by being the fixer or the person who knows more or something like that. And I don't, you often start with that intention, but it's some little thing gets said in the middle of whatever's going on, and all of a sudden something got stroked, and ego pops out, and it's like, wah! and takes over, and I'm like, down you go, you know, like, and it's really hard. But for me, that's something I notice when I'm listening. I have to really watch, because otherwise then I start spouting instead of listening, and then I start having an idea that I know the answer instead of hearing what's the need. So that's, for me, what's very difficult. And I think that it comes up in a lot of the lists you said. There's like, I'm like, oh, that's me. But when I see the theme there, it's really ego stroking. It's my ego coming out, you know, and I don't know. I think in some areas it's easier for me, but in that area it's more difficult. But you know, I'm not the only one.
Thank you.
I was just going to say that for me, the thing I deal with sometimes, especially with a family member that's really dysfunctional, is the manipulation that goes on, taking advantage of my compassion, love, and caring. Mm-hmm. So then, it's sometimes I just have to detach with love. And I can't be there like I would like to be because of all the manipulation that goes on. Mm-hmm. So, that happens too.
I think giving without the expectation of what's going to be done with the gift is really hard, I think. So, because, you know, you give your money or give your love or you give your time or you give your something, and then if the person goes and uses it in a way that you feel is damaging to them, you know, I don't know. It's very tricky. Very tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, I was involved in some 12-step programs, and maybe they speak to that in different language than Buddhism. But, you know, they have, you know, like, for example, Al-Anon, they have, you know, ideas about boundaries and how, you know, you don't really want to hate a situation that's bad, you know, and it's a different model than in Buddhism, but I think it can be helpful for, you know, some of these real-life situations are just so painful and tricky, you know, like, you have a child who's drug addict, and you know, you want them, you hope that this time the rehab will take, and they want to, you know, come and visit, and they need some money, and you know, it's just so difficult. So
that's when you really have to take care of yourself, you know, because you don't want to close yourself off completely, but it's painful, because if it's a child that you love and they keep, you know, falling down and getting back into it, you want to, you know, take care of yourself as well, because it's continual, almost like abuse going back into it.
Yeah. It's like that acrobat story, you know. So you're the person on top, and your child is, you know, intoxicated below. You want to climb down and get off right away, not say, okay, you know, take a step to the left, take a step to the right, and, you know, you want to.
Right. One thing we didn't get into today was equanimity practice, which speaks to that, which is the idea that you can offer all of your best wishes for this other person, but they are the person that has to take the actions to benefit themselves. And I find that that's really helpful at times, to realize that the boundary stops at the boundary of my skin. And so I have to be willing to say, okay, here's what I can do. And then if the person doesn't pick that up or do the right thing with it, that's, you know, it's kind of a cliche-ish way to say it. It's their karma. But it is. It's their choice to make particular actions from there. And I think that that can give us some stability in that, or some way to at least hold that in a different way. To realize we don't have to beat ourselves up if they're still hurting themselves.
And the equanimity practice is really difficult to do. I mean, I think it takes time to really stabilize and loving kindness practice and to really start to see one's own patterns and how we get stuck, you know, how we cling to or push away. But it is a very powerful practice.
Like boundaries with our children.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I try to remind myself is non-attachment to the outcome, so that if I'm giving something and you give it and then you let go, and not thinking that they have to do it the way you want them to do it or spend it the way you want them to spend it. Maybe that would be the same with giving to a homeless person, you know. Mm-hmm. Non-attachment to the outcome, just pass it on. And
I think there's a lot of relief in that too, because when you cling to what that you want them to do with it, when they don't, which, you know, most people don't, they do exactly what you want, you know, you're clinging to that, and so there's like suffer, you know, and very rarely do they actually do exactly what you want, and it's this false sense of that you can control, like you said, what goes beyond your hands, and you just mm-hmm. can't. So trying to, it's just suffering.
It seems like some of the organizations that you became involved in helping and providing services for came from organizations that you were familiar with or people that you were familiar with. And I know that we've been looking for, our Sonia has been looking for something to do that we could all agree upon or what have you. We haven't come up with that yet, but I think the exposure to what you presented to us today really kind of opens the possibilities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, we look right in our community, and there's so much need. There's so much need everywhere right now that you could just choose anything to be of service to, and it would be fine. But I kind of like the organized way to go about looking for a way to help or to provide services for. So I thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Yeah, it gives you a vehicle to work more with the Dharma, you know, because as you go out, let's say you choose some community project, like, you know, we have the homeless shelter that we provide, and that's a very small thing, but mm-hmm. the volunteers that go on that, they just feel so much togetherness. They have an opportunity to talk about stuff that comes up, you know, and you know, how to work with things skillfully. And what we're trying to do with Insight World Aid is to, you know, have Gil as our main teacher to really hold the whole service organization with those teachings. And there's some of his references on the website, some talks that he's given and articles that he's given. But, you know, we're really hoping that he or one of the other teachers we're involved with will come on these trips with us, for example, to Asia, and, you know, won't just be working in the coal mines, you know, we'll be actually meditating together and, you know, talking about, you know, how to frame things in a Buddhist context and work with things, you know, using our Dharma practice. Any last-minute comments or needs or questions? Just have a couple minutes left.
I've learned a lot.
Yeah, thank you for coming. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Yeah, it's been a real delight today, and very, I'm very heartened by the depth of the practice here. And, you know, I know all of you have been involved in service for many years, and many of you have been meditating a little while, and some have been meditating for many years, and it's just lovely to see such a strong group, and I understand there's others here in town too, so that's, it's great to share the Dharma with you. Thank you.
Thank you.